Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Alan Chung about his latest edited volume, edited together with Quang Min Pham, Critical Reflections on China's Belt and Road Initiative. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Alan, I wonder if we could start off with a bit of an intellectual biography of yourself and how you got to editing this or co-editing this book.
Well, it all started with conversations with the late LHM Ling, better known as Lily Ling. She knew that I was getting into this exotic interdisciplinary area called Asian International Relations Thought, which again blends very easily into the study of Asian political thought, past, present, and future, and so on. So it came out of that, and it started on the sidelines of the International Studies Association Annual Convention, roughly in 2014. I can't remember exactly where that was held. But certainly, we had a very good lunch to ease into this future pipeline of projects. And this was actually the second collaboration with her before she passed away, sadly, in late 2018. It came out partly of her interest in trying to understand how Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative was actually a very fortuitous turn of events, let's put it that way, in which Asians were now encouraged to talk to one another across political, social, economic, cultural barriers. And in this sense, the Belt and Road Initiative could go a lot further than what during the Cold War one might call, you know, the non-aligned movement, or, you know, in the 1990s, there was this popularity with the so-called South-South dialogue, you know. So the Belt and Road Initiative actually goes a lot further than that in terms of its economic, social, political, and intellectual momentum. So this is how it got started. And Lily wanted to push several projects out by getting funding, grants, and so on from any available quarter. So I, on my part, managed to get the Jeju Forum on Peace and Prosperity, the one based in the famous tourist island of Jeju in South Korea, to fund the first workshop of sorts. Well, we couldn't call it a workshop because that forum, you know, wants something oriented towards Asian perspectives on peace and, you know, prosperity, economic growth, and so on. So we spun that first session into something titled Revisiting the Ancient Silk Roads, you know, an alternative to neoliberal globalization. Coming from the United States, you know, understandably, Lily was very much on the attack against neoliberal globalization. So, you know, that's how the first project turned up in Jeju. And we managed to spin it into a journal special issue in the Asian Journal of Comparative Politics. So that was successfully published before she passed away. In the meantime, she had published several pieces on her own about how China's rise needed to be analyzed in terms of the yin and the yang of Taoism, blended with Confucianism and so on. So all these things came together in Hanoi in late 2017, thanks to the generous funding by Quang Minh Pham at the Vietnam National University, drawing on his collaboration with the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, based in Vietnam. We managed to get the funds to fly a number of, from Vietnam's perspective, that is, foreign speakers in, myself included. And Lily was so thrilled because it was, I think, her first time in Vietnam, if I recall correctly. You know, and she landed, I remember, around about half an hour before midnight. And we had a very unusual late night supper session. Of course, I had a good dinner before that, the official dinner, which she missed because of the strange, you know, poor coincidence of flight timings from the United States. So she flew all the way, you know, roughly, I think, 15 to 16 hours from New York, you know, across the United States, across the Pacific, transited in Hong Kong and ended up in Hanoi. So anyway, she was still very alert and you know, very talkative at that late hour. So we chatted about this project and several others way into the wee small hours of the morning. So you can imagine the next morning, everybody showed up just in time for the proceedings of the workshop. So anyway, she was going on and on about how we needed to take control of this intellectual narrative away from the usual China threat thesis, and in many ways also away from Chinese authoritarianism, and definitely away from the American rhetoric. I should correct myself, that mainstream American rhetoric of neoliberal globalization as a lens through which to view the Belt and Road Initiative. Because if you look at it, Chinese expectations and, you know, flexibility in negotiating these deals do not, what do you call, fit the IMF World Bank orthodoxy in any case. Now, coming down to the book, I've had actually, along with Quang Minh Pham, quite a bit of difficulty trying to render it as academic as possible, in the sense that many of the papers initially submitted to that workshop in Hanoi were policy critiques. You know, they had some kind of general research question, you know, driving these papers, but they were meant to be reading for time-pressed policymakers. So, you know, that was a bit of a challenge trying to transform these so-called bullet point type policy think pieces into workable paragraphs that had something that resembled the elegance of a fully thought out chapter. And then at the other extreme, there were the chapters by Lily Ling herself, looking at how you could literally, in the title of her chapter, Square the Circle, discuss Chinese hegemony or imputed Chinese hegemony over the Belt and Road, together with the idea that this was an Asian perspective on world order at the same time. And of course, we did not need to fit Xi Jinping's mold of a totalitarian world order, but, you know, we could, of course, revive, okay, his subtext as the main text, i.e. the idea of revisiting the ancient Silk Roads as inspiration for the modern Silk Roads, however many there may be. Of course, today we can count the Health Silk Road, the Digital Silk Road, the 21st Century Maritime Silk Road, and of course the Landed Silk Roads, which are many in themselves, many of which thread through the Middle East, thread through Central Asia, and link, you know, basically the Asias, in plural here, that is, that have never been so-called deeply intertwined with one another since the end of colonialism and so on. So the chapters in the book, if I can just quickly, you know, mention in passing, just to keep you, the reader and listener, interested, you know, cover a wide gamut of perspectives, again, all adhering to the idea of critical readings. First of all, the first two chapters, basically Lily Ling and myself, sought to imagine the Silk Roads through philosophy and history. We drew a lot of inspiration from Buddhism, Pan-Asianism, the writings of ancient travelers, some of whom were Buddhist, some were very worldly Islamic thinkers. Then there was Marco Polo himself, all right, who was Catholic, but, you know, a very open-minded Catholic who didn't pass judgment when he reached Kublai Khan's court in China, okay, which was fascinating. And you think about Sino-US tensions today, you know, how different that is. Okay, back then, people were open-minded. We didn't pass judgments just like that. We also looked at critical geographies on the road. And in this sense, we have tried very hard to suggest that there's so much more to critical geographies through studying the Belt and Road than meets the eye. You know, my Vietnamese co-authors, Quang Minh Pham, and his collaborator, you know, suggested that we needed to think of this revived Silk Roads as a way of understanding dilemmatic geography, meaning there are dilemmas to it. All right. And then we have this Vietnamese historian, Trinh Van Dinh, who talked about the need to understand infrastructure frenzy or infrastructure fetishism in terms of Chinese empire building in the 21st century and so forth. And of course, there's the railroad chapter by Wu Xiangsu, who pays attention to the fact that this can be seen as empire building through the medium of railroads, or it can be seen as a new phase of globalization, you know, interior globalization or landed globalization, if you will, where railroads are connecting countries within the multiple Asias that you know, we know exist out there, but who have not been as closely integrated as one would have liked. And the original Silk Road did represent a kind of plasticine cosmopolitanism that few people have fully appreciated. And the railroad could actually bring so much of the Middle East and East Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia, so much closer than ever before. And of course, there was long ago the Maritime Silk Roads that is going to be strengthened immeasurably with the BRI. The critical political economy section is somewhat more conventional in its criticism, in the sense that they look closely at how Chinese investments have fit the new colonial pattern or not. So there's that. And of course, being located in Vietnam, this workshop had to produce a number of critical national perspectives. So for instance, one of the Vietnamese authors was very interestingly engaged in deeply reading trends in American officialdom, where she suggests that they were, you know, involved in this, or rather they were wrapping themselves in this deep contradiction of, you know, saying that they want in on the business angle of the BRI. But on the other hand, you know, the official rhetoric is that China is a threat, a rising threat, as a great power. So we'll have little to do with the BRI as far as possible. So there are all these going on. And, you know, I'll leave the conclusion, you know, for you to enjoy the suspense of reading it, where I do touch on empire, the notion of empire in relation to China. I do touch on the new developmentalism. And I think also that the whole idea of the BRI intellectually challenges us to think about connecting within Asia, a theme which I've been saying, you know, throughout this podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. That introduction is indeed very helpful. It also leads me to what my overall impression is from reading the book. And that, in fact, in many ways transcends Asia in the sense that it really is about, you know, building a new global world order and inclusive and cohesive societies that can manage the interests of all stakeholders, as well as political, cultural, ethnic, and religious differences. It's an approach that departs markedly from the bulk of the analysis of the Belt and Road. You've talked a little bit about what led you to that, but maybe you can expand on that a little bit.
In the sense that I have this abiding interest in Asian international relations theory. Is that the angle?
Whichever angle, what I'm trying to suggest is that obviously your interest in Asian international relations theory was your entry point. But I'm suggesting that this goes far beyond that, that it's much more, in a sense, universal or global.
Okay, thank you for that particular comment. I'm actually quite thrilled to hear this because I had not thought that this book would have this, you know, possibility of transcendence, all right? My primary interest, okay, which is anchored to my rather lengthy chapter, looking at Silk Road cosmopolitanism via what I call mercantile harmony, was just that, you know, I wasn't thinking about the point of inception of the political economy angles, the critical geography elements, and so on. But then, you know, it came down to someone having to spearhead this project, because one of Lily's promises, okay, sadly before her tragic passing away, was that she would edit what we joked as the mother of all volumes on the Belt and Road initiative. But sadly, she passed away. So, you know, I hope that this would not be the end of this network that she set up, you see. So I thought that I at least owe it to her memory to see this through to publication. And so it is, all right? And in the book launch yesterday, I deliberately highlighted the picture on the cover, all right? Just so that, you know, readers who pick this up will understand that a lot of thought went into the choice of the cover. Now, this is a picture of a lonely border outpost, desolate, bleak, and so on. It looked like nature was actually the dominant feature in the landscape. And then humankind had artificially created this border gate, and so on. But this is exactly so emblematic of the entire Belt and Road project. It is, in a way, tabula rasa for building new connections between the many Asias that, you know, don't come to our normal consciousness of world affairs.
I want to just stay on this theme for a little while and push you a little bit, if I may, in the sense is that implicitly, I think, in some parts, even explicitly in the book, you're talking about the Belt and Road inter-Asia connections as basically being a mechanism to create a more equal, more inclusive world. And it strikes me that that may be a hard sell in a polarized world in which prejudice and bias and policies that flow from it have gained new legitimacy and become mainstream.
Yeah, that is a helpful provocation. As an academic, one, of course, needs to divide one's time and responsibilities towards servicing whoever pays my salary, which is, in my case, the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, with this very practical policy orientation. But on the other hand, you know, I'm still a dyed-in-the-wool academic. And in that sense, I have to still write with the hope that my writing can lift the curtains or draw the curtains, depending on your preferred analogy, on the inspirations that have always been with us from the past. So in this sense, so much of Asia, I think, has grown up thinking that we were baked in modernity from day one, but we have not been. Okay, insofar as the word modernity can be used to label present-day Asia, we have a hybridized, highly hybridized modernity. You know, every time I visit any East Asian country, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, South Korea, any ASEAN country, okay, sadly, I'm yet to set foot on mainland China. I'm astounded by the fact that people do not embrace modernity in the way that Americans would or Europeans would. In fact, I find some intellectual affinity with, you know, the European countries that have produced great philosophers like the UK, like the French, like the Germans, and, you know, further down the line, the Italians and the Spaniards. In the sense that much as they have embraced, you know, digital technology here and there, high-speed railways, the idea that, you know, you can pre-book hotel rooms and check in online, things like that, they've also retained a certain sense that we are who we are from the past, you know, and some things should never change despite the advances of technology. Whereas if you land at most American airports in big cities, you know, and I suppose this will continue post-COVID-19, you are faced with a challenge to all your senses, because there's so much of high technology surrounding you and forcing you to interface with a very post-human experience. I can't think of a better word at the moment. You know, you think about your automatic passport scanner, your flight ticket reader. You know, that's so inhuman. You know, whereas you go to certain European airports, you know, and across Asia, you still have the human agent there serving you, you know, and asking you, you know, in terms of an interpersonal form of verification, have you got fully confirmed bookings for your stay in that country, or have you got onward bookings and so on and so forth? You know, which makes you feel more like a human being. So this is what, you know, animates my academic writings, that at the end of the day, you know, it's not technology that's the author of, you know, our improvements in life. You know, it's still a human being at the end of it.
Indeed, that's absolutely true. I want to pursue this just with one more question, and that's in Lily Ling's chapter, in which she talks about the need of a global agenda to take the need of ordinary people into account to ensure that we have a more inclusive world. And the question is, how do you achieve that?
That's where, you know, academia, okay, I can't speak about government, but civil society definitely is one of the pillars of this so-called ground-up initiative, all right? So I do believe in civil society, whether you call it transnational civil society, national civil society, or just global civil society. And I think academia is part and parcel of this movement, all right, to try to wrest control of the narrative of the 21st century from governments, governments that often are, you know, flat-footed, you know, ham-fisted and so on. You know, you look at COVID-19, some of the stories of protection, welfare, care, you know, comfort come from ground-up initiatives. And governments have by and large messed up, you know, the front end of trying to contain the situation. So this is roughly where, you know, I stand as an academic. I believe that my writing will make a difference. You know, it's a Sisyphean task, or, you know, it's a David and Goliath task, if you prefer the other analogy. And, you know, it doesn't mean that I'm rabidly anti-American or anti-Western. It's just that I think that academia needs to democratize, especially in international relations, where, you know, the founding texts were all written by people from colonial metropoles from 2 centuries ago, you know. And of course, those in the last century have, you know, continued to be regarded, all right, as a kind of orthodoxy that interpreted their forebears and that nothing should be changed. So that's where my writing is going, notwithstanding the occasional piece that looks at a very practical problem concerning security in Asia. But by and large, I think in the long term, you know, I will be writing about how we need to revalue Asia's intellectual heritage, including those of its first generation nationalists.
Related to this, you draw a contrast, a stark contrast, between the ancient and the current Silk Road. Can you expand and describe that contrast?
Certainly. The ancient Silk Roads were low on technology, all right? If you pick up Marco Polo, Farsian, Ibn Battuta, you realize that there was constant danger at every step of the way from nature, all right? And because all of humanity, anyone you encounter on the road, could potentially be your friend because they have lived there. They know how to deal with these elements, the attacks by wild animals, even the shift of the ground because of the wind direction and so on and so forth. So that I think was very different from today, where you assume that technology will make sure that your journey on the modern Silk Road is just smooth. You don't think, because technology acts as this cocoon of security for you. So maybe, you know, in that sense, operating in a low-tech environment makes you more aware of your common humanity with the people, the fellow traveler, between inverted commas, that you encounter along the Silk Roads, you know. excuse me. Whereas the modern assumes that technology will do all that. But even then, modern technology does not diminish completely obstacles arising from culture. excuse me, my throat's a bit dry. Obstacles arising from culture. And there's so much cultural proliferation and variety along the modern Silk Roads that have predated the arrival of modern ways of government, modern technology, the Westphalian state, and so on. I haven't been to Central Asia myself, but you know, having made a few friends who are academics, displaced from Central Asia, and much of it was, by the way, the former Cold War territories of the Soviet Union, the erstwhile Soviet Union. You know, you realize that there's so much humanity, Asian humanity, that you find in common, right, with people from Central Asia. They actually shared this Confucian heritage from what is today, you know, the People's Republic of China. And the irony is, the People's Republic of China, I think, is treading very carefully, politically, you know, doctoring parts of their Confucian Taoist legacy, just so that it doesn't upset the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. You know, it's tragic in one sense, in the sense that, you know, this is not an orthodox Communist Party in charge in China. You know, they should, you know, openly embrace the fact that they are the successors to this very rich 2,000 plus years worth of heritage. Instead, you know, they're fighting this cultural war against things that might undermine Communist Party rule, which is, I think, against the current of history. Whereas if you go back to, you know, these kinds of roots, you can actually find common frequency in building confidence with your neighbors, not just with Mongolia, it's also with the two Koreas, with Japan. You know, so this Sino-Japanese antagonism that, you know, has fueled so many careers in mainstream academia, it's just a product of both states trying to be too modern for their own good. Because if you look at the past, nobody drew tight Westphalian-type boundaries. And the ancient Silk Roads revealed that travelers just filtered themselves east and west, you know, and stopped wherever people showed them hospitality. Nobody said this was, you know, absolutely the border of this kingdom. Therefore, if you don't have a proper passport, you're thrown out. No, it wasn't like that. And I don't know if your listeners, readers, have time to actually read Marco Polo's The Travels. Now, that is not a tourist book, you know, as some people might have it. It is actually a running political commentary of how someone from the former Roman Empire, because Marco Polo lived in that period, that medieval period, that still looked back at the glory of the Roman Empire. You know, he traveled to the court of Kublai Khan, and the picture he painted was not that of a murderous, you know, bound, you know, cannibalistic horde. It was far from it. In fact, Kublai Khan was depicted, I think, very sympathetically, and I've done the research. It does check out with, you know, other historians' accounts of Kublai Khan. You know, that he was harsh in some ways, but he was also just, and he had you know, demonstrated, you know, that he could behave in the tradition of the best of Confucianism and Taoism and so on.
You know, in some ways, I think, and this harks into what you just said. In some ways, you know, your analysis suggests that the contrast between the ancient Silk Road and the current Chinese Belt and Road effort. I'm sorry. In some ways, and this harks back into what you were just explaining, it strikes me that the contrast between the ancient Silk Road and the current Chinese efforts makes dubbing the Belt and Road as a new Silk Road. Ooh, sorry about that, Alan.
The air is dry today.
Yeah, let me try this again. Harking it onto what you just explained, it strikes me that in some ways, the contrast that you would describing between the ancient Silk Road and the current Chinese efforts makes dubbing the Belt and Road as the new Silk Road a misnomer, because the new Silk Road in many ways was everything that the antique road was not.
Yes, yes. In a sense, I perhaps have not been very precise in drawing a line between the new Silk Roads and the old Silk Roads. But, you know, I leave that perhaps to critics of my book or people who would produce books on the Belt and Road Initiative after me and Kuang Min Fang. You know, we've used these terms very loosely throughout the book, in part because we wanted to accommodate the diversity out there. And what's interesting about the Vietnamese perspectives, because I suspect some of your listeners and readers might approach the Vietnamese contributions as somewhat too closely tied to an authoritarian government. But I urge them to look beyond it, because that sort of situated perspective also provides a learning point in the sense that they do see, the need to connect the past to the present, and in some ways also through the critical readings of China's intentions, are attempting to encourage China to reconnect with its early spurt of idealism under the first phase of Mao Zedong's rule. All right, Mao Zedong, of course, is remembered for being the, between inverted commas, winner of the Chinese Civil War that followed immediately after Japan's defeat in the Pacific War. All right, but you see, Mao wanted to speak from the new China that he founded, called the People's Republic, to the rest of the then Third World. All right, as an experiment in possibility. Okay, I'm using this phrase loosely in the sense that he was simultaneously addressing, okay, in his many speeches, both his domestic audience as well as fellow so-called decolonized territories. That, look, you know, we are now turning a page in world history because we need to make the post-colonial state work, all right, for its people and for keeping the flame of liberation, all right, from all forms of colonialism, neo-imperialism, neo-colonialism, etc., alive. And this is how history should go forward, that we need to democratize the world order away from the idea of Western Empire. So the Vietnamese chapters, I think, were speaking to that first phase of Mao Zedong's idealism, even if they didn't spell it out that way. And this was also an eye-opener for me into the intellectual side of Vietnamese intelligentsia today. You know, that much as you hear all the things about how the Vietnamese Communist Party is controlling so many aspects of public life there, you have professors willing to write these things, right? Of course, you can say that, you know, it was safe because they didn't criticize their own government. All right, a fair counter criticism. But then that was not the point. We were talking about the Belt and Road initiated by China. And I think most of the Vietnamese chapters have also been fair to the Chinese in the sense that they did suggest that the world needs to take a more objective view of what the Chinese can bring to the table through the development, mode of the Belt and Road Initiative.
And yet many of the issues that you describe with which travelers like Fa Hsien, Marco Polo, Ibn Battuta were grappling are issues that we are attempting to tackle today. Parameters of human interaction, virtue, diversity, governance, materialism, and the role of religion. So in many ways, what we're talking about really is the same issues in ancient times that we're talking about today.
Yes, indeed. And I can't understand why, not many academics associated with the mainstream international relations schools are not looking at cultural interaction in this globalizing world. And the fact that you have got issues like Black Lives Matter coming up and then, inspiring equally passionate anti-colonial movements or decolonial movements from the grassroots in so many other countries, you know, says something about how globalization actually is increasingly going to have to be reappropriated by people on the ground, all right? It's not just about CEOs and companies saying, we need to open up borders so I can provide your people employment and repatriate my profits and to sell you consumer goods and so on and so forth. You know, it's not that kind of top-down corporate globalization, you know, that we should be talking about in the 21st century. It's about people meeting people and trying to understand that, you know, there's so much diversity out there that, you know, the greatest common frequency we have is our humanity. All right. So, you know, if you look at relations between the West and Islam, you know, why do you need to focus on the fact that we are worshipping gods under different names, you know? And we've got different religious holidays and so on. Why can't we understand it in terms of common humanity? And I'm sure, you know, Osama bin Laden, and of course I can't remember the current head of ISIS, they're not people who are universally liked across the Arab world. You know, they do not epitomize, I think, ordinary, down-to-earth Arab people. All right? And in fact, I should also add to Lily Ling's credit, in this network that she set up, we had a number of people like Manoche. I thought Manoche was a wonderful chap. You know, I'd never met an Iranian-American before. I've got another collaborator who's, in a sense, a very, secular Arab, if I can coin that term. He grew up, okay, still being able to read fluently and speaking fluently in Arabic. But he spent all his time, you know, all around the world, in Canada, in France, in parts of Europe and so on. And of course, he spent a good part of the early phase of his assistant professorship in Qatar. So, you know, this is a cosmopolitan Arab, and there are plenty out there whom you can talk to. And this is, I think, where, you know, the subtext of my book, you know, encourages future scholars to pick this up.
Just for the listener, you were referring to Manoushe Doraj, an American,
yes,
an Iranian-American scholar who contributed the chapter to your book on China's relations, primarily with Iran, but also with Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And perhaps if we have time, we'll get back to that. I want to stick for a moment with the travelers, because one of the basic arguments, if I understood it correctly, that you make is that they were able to manage all of this diversity and differences because they encountered or had similar experiences and encountered similar threats.
Yes.
And the question is, how does one replicate or apply that experience in today's world?
Okay, first of all, the idea of human security is there. You know, every human being has a right to feel secure, not just, you know, by having a roof over their heads and enough to eat and so on, but also in terms of cultural security. I know the academic research out there is not sufficiently up to speed on this, but cultural security is important. You know, when people cross borders, they should not feel that their culture is being despised by the host automatically. And you know, I can say that some of this happens even in cosmopolitan Singapore, where, you know, migrant workers are sometimes looked down upon, all right, by ordinary Singaporeans on public transport and so on. And I think, you know, this fear has partially diminished in the wake of, you know, the shared suffering, right, between the migrant workers and Singaporeans during the current pandemic. And you realize that there are lots of well-meaning Singaporeans who are willing to step up to say, look, you know, if you are infected and you suffer from COVID-19, which is an extreme form of flu, you know, we will help you, all right? And I think, you know, it's this spirit of understanding that our common humanity that should be out there, you know? And of course, I can't say that, you know, I was that idealistic consistently all my life, you know, but academia, I think, through the training of the mind, through philosophy, history, and so on, you know, does open up your human boundaries as well in many ways. I should also want to highlight the fact, again, I wasn't sure whether to push this point, that one other important theme that came out of my chapter is this idea of mercantile harmony linked, okay, to the conjoining, okay, of the worlds of material commerce, meaning buying, selling, things like that, the exchange of funds, etc., and the spiritual realm. You know, in today's understanding of religion, very often, you know, preachers would say, let's separate the two realms. One is godly, one is ungodly. But if you look at the accounts of some of these ancient travelers, you know, they did not make this clear distinction. It was all fudged. All right. I'm not saying that all the four persons that I studied were all saints. But, you know, they were recording life as it were then. And now, Ibn Battuta, a thinker whom I have got to read, you know, several times over, actually recorded Mecca to be an important emporium and a gourmet paradise. You know, this is extremely politically incorrect today, you know, but that was the way he recorded it. All right, I still remember that phrase, and I don't think the translation was wrong, that Mecca was where you find the best meats, M-E-A-T-S, all right, for his time, which said a lot about, you know, how the material world can coexist with the spiritual realm. All right. And Marco Polo was also all about this. You know, in the tone of his writings, he also did not draw clear distinctions between, you know, the worldly quality of his profession. He was a trader. And his family was, his entire family, extended family, were all traders. So they were worldly people. And, you know, when he recorded what went on in all the kingdoms he encountered along the ancient Silk Road, you know, there was a certain sense that moral propriety or justice was to be recorded accurately and respected wherever it was to be found evident.
This may be a tricky question, but you referred to the limitations of the political system in Vietnam as well as in China. And that really raises the question of the value of people-to-people contact, given that people from more autocratic or authoritarian systems may not feel at ease expressing themselves freely and be cautious. And of course, you have a China that imposes its narrative with the stick of economic sanctions on those beyond its borders. So the question is, what is the value of people-to-people contact in a context like that?
Ah, okay, excellent point. Now, if you dissect President Xi's speech at the first Belt and Road Summit in Beijing, he actually let this cat out of the bag. You know, he called for more intensive people-to-people interactions. So in that sense, you can say that he might be strung on the horns of a dilemma. On the one hand, this is what his rhetoric says, more people-to-people contact potentially leading to contamination from abroad of, you know, more tolerant ideas or ideas of toleration. And then on the other hand, you know, President Xi has all these draconian controls on the internet, or rather the Chinese internet behind the firewall and so on. You know, and of course, we hear all those stories about Xinjiang, and then, of course, the political fallout from the ongoing Hollywood production of Mulan. Yeah, you're right. But you see, people-to-people contact cannot be completely controlled, you know. And of course, I'm aware that China is extremely concerned. To the point of sending, I suppose you can't call them spies in a conventional sense, but people who monitor their own citizens' behavior and comments outside of China. China is known to do that. The Vietnamese, I'm not sure. Maybe they have done that also. But then, you see, if you want to integrate economically, okay, let's talk about something that's low political or supposedly non-political, like economic interactions. You have to allow your people to get into degrees of contaminating contact with outside ideas. So this is where I think I can't make this point any more delicately or objectively. But the fact is, you know, when authoritarian regimes or totalitarian regimes, if you prefer, engage in the people-to-people globalization, the chances of extreme leakage. Okay, the word leakage, again, is something in the discourse of authoritarian powers. They're afraid, all right, that, you know, the authoritarian controls will leak once the people go outside their borders and so on. The potential for leakage is there, will always be there. And I think this is one way in which China can also learn to manage its rise to great power status even better. At some point, you need to take a leaf from your own past. Okay, Kublai Khan, for instance. You know, he was also bloody. He put a lot of what he termed as, you know, social undesirables to death. But, you know, when it came to the ordinary people, the poor, you know, he showed them generosity as a paternalistic fatherly figure in the mold of Confucianism and Taoism would.
Sticking for a moment with the Belt and Road itself, you signal two major issues with the Belt and Road Initiative, and that is that it's top-down and China-centric. Would you want to elaborate on that?
Well, the Chinese have tried to control the narrative way too hard. As one of the speakers at the book launch yesterday pointed out, and, you know, that's where, you know, I think they are learning very fast to, you know, reel themselves back from that kind of extreme position. and that, you know, you need the buy-in of your partners as well as, you know, the people on the ground affected by your projects. And that's where perhaps one would look forward to future Sri Lankan voices, for instance, African voices, voices from across Southeast Asia that would adopt a more objective view of the promise of the Belt and Road, you know, and not have the Chinese quickly come in to say, oh, you know, you ought to view it in this other way, and so on. And, you know, this is where I think China, by learning to tweak the Belt and Road 2.0, insofar as you can use that label, you know, will listen to alternative voices, voices less constrained by Beijing's preferences, all right, to speak up for it.
I want to return to another much more broader subject that you suggest in the book and that we were talking about at the beginning of this interview, which is that in order to manage different value systems and interests, one would have to water down the Westphalian dogma of treating national interests as zero-sum conceptions. My question is, how do you do that, and what did you have in mind in terms of watering down that absoluteness of the notion of national interests?
Well, first of all, I think all citizens of existing nation states should learn to embrace diversity. You know, that people have different ways of practicing culture on top of our common humanity, and that this is a legitimate right. Unfortunately, we have in the White House right now a president who does not believe in that. And, you know, I have to make reference to, you know, the occupant of the White House in Washington, D.C., because, you know, like it or not, that is still an important pulpit for trying to influence the world. And of course, Beijing can be the alternative pulpit. But President Xi and his colleagues in power, I think, need to understand that the Belt and Road can achieve its full potential only if some degree of diversity is allowed to flourish, all right, against the official preference. And this is where I think the Westphalian system will come under erosion. It won't be totally dismantled overnight, but it needs to relax its controls, its obsession with, you know, a dominant national narrative all the time. And you see this also even in so-called cosmopolitan Singapore, this constant tug of war between an official nationalism and then what's happening on the ground, you see? All states facing this COVID-19 pandemic will have to make this choice. On the one hand, closed borders can provide some degree of protection against the further spread of the virus. But on the other hand, you need to keep a good number of doors to the rest of the world open, because they will bring your relief supplies, your normality, okay, through daily commerce back into your life. All right, and now this is off the bounds of today's discussion, I suppose, but tourism. Now, tourism is a much underappreciated dimension of globalization, social, political, economic, you name it. And tourism has been, I think, an important part of ensuring that the European Union stays as it is. You know, and one cannot help but be struck by this spectacle of, you know, many Europeans, including the British, who are still embracing Brexit like crazy, you know, felt that they needed to celebrate tourism the moment the lockdowns ended from the first wave. You see, of course, now they're being told by their government, sorry, you know, we have to turn the clock back to put you under lockdown again to, you know, defeat the second wave of infections. You know, but the point I'm making is tourism means that we cannot go back to a rigid Westphalian system, because we need each other's different, you know, cultural and visual pastures, all right, to let our people breathe and live as human beings, all right? Even in Asia, I think the moment, you know, significant national lockdowns are over, and I believe Thailand is at the forefront of this, they're counting the days down to the first mass tourist flights back into the country, because they realize that it's not just good for the economy, it's also good for giving the citizens a sense of normality.
Alan, this has been fascinating, and we could go on for another hour, and I have many other questions.
I'm surprised, and thankful that you've allowed, 55 minutes now?
Indeed, and I see that's exactly it. I see the clock ticking. But before I let you go, I want to ask you what your plans are after this book. You've referred a couple of times to this being part of a larger project, there being a pipeline. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit on where you go from here.
Well, Lili Ling's passing left a huge hole in this pipeline, which a few of us, I think, are still talking about filling. You see, the problem is that many of us in this network are not yet fully tenured professors, you see. So we have to pay attention to our own publication records and other admin duties. So professionally, I think, you know, we are at a turning point where you need someone to stand up to say, you know, let me put the team back together to edit the next big book on the Belt and Road. Clearly, this volume that I've just launched yesterday is a drop in the ocean. Okay, I have to be modest about my efforts. It could have gone into so many other directions. But, you know, the constraints of time, you know, and my responsibilities to the people who put together the original Hanoi workshop or conference, you know, needed to take precedence. I would have liked more chapters on the philosophical angle, on the sociological angle, for instance. You know, but the essence of time pressures dictated otherwise, right? So that, I think, will be in the offing. And in the meantime, I'm also working on a much-delayed manuscript on international communication as an angle of international relations. So this book has been on the back burner during the lockdown here in Singapore. I couldn't get any writing done because there was so much admin that was just going on online. So I hope to return to it in a month or two on top of my responsibilities here at the Center for Multilateralism Studies.
That sounds like a fascinating project.
Perhaps we can have another interview like this after.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you didn't have the constraints, what would the next big book on the Belt and Road be?
Okay, we need to, I think, go past all the themes that were discussed at the launch yesterday, you know, about debt trap diplomacy, dependency, differences between eight models, you know, and how China's rise is benign or not. We need to go beyond all that. And I think the huge gap out there is the philosophical and historical angle. That needs to be filled. And here I need to acknowledge also the existing works by a number of sociologists, anthropologists, and historians who produced books on the Silk Road way before it became fashionable again under President Xi. And of course, that magnificent work of popular Silk Road history by Peter Frankel Pan, which I've cited in this book. You know, I think he's written an eminently readable popular history of the Silk Road that takes it up to the 20th century. And interestingly, Frankel Pan's book addresses the fact that after World War II, Britain and the United States actually were interested in the Silk Road because of the oil that lay astride that part of it, you know, running through the Middle East and Central Asia. All that has been out there for a few years now. So the philosophy and the history needs to come together, I think, in a more unique volume. And that's something I'm still trying to wrap my head around. But I also need to think about who in Lily's original network can help deliver on that. Because the same people who delivered for this book are probably not going to be interested in this next volume that I'm trying to imagine.
Alan, it's been fascinating to discuss a book that I think really brings originality to the literature on the Belt and Road and also highlights dimensions and perspectives that have either not been recognized or have been underrated until now. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it and wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure too.